the diagnostics for it became more. So we're seeing more of it globally. The WHO put out a report in the last few years. They are saying, you know, many more stecs or EHECs are the problem, and these are the things we should focus on. And it doesn't matter if they're 0157 or one of these other serogroups. Anything that's making sugar toxin and can bind inside of a person and cause an infection is a high priority. And so that shifting focus and definition, it kind of keeps broadening the net of steck that we want to try and monitor and keep out of beef and other foods.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Molinix, and today I'm excited to have Mick Balsovic with me today. Welcome to the show, Mick.
Glad to be here.
So a little different topic for me, a little something out of my wheelhouse, and talking about food safety and pathogens, etc. And so excited to get in, discussing some of this. That's totally different than stuff that I think about and that I do on a daily basis. So Meg, just to give us a little background, I know you work at Clay Center at the ARS station there, Meat Animal Research Center there in Clay Center, Nebraska. Just give the audience the background of what you do and how you got there.
All right. Well, I'm a research microbiologist with the meat in the Meat Quality and Safety Research Unit there in Clay Center. Work for ARS, the Ag Research Service, part of USDA. Our research unit is focused on quality and then safety. Safety is my side of things. I was kind of recruited back into the unit 25 years ago when more molecular biology skills and tools were needed. So back then, there were a lot of food microbiologists, but not many people applying, you know, things we take for granted, like PCR and these things to detect pathogens. So I was kind of hired in to bring in that sort of set of tools and apply them to food safety. Before that, you know, I had not much of a background for food safety. I came from clinical and diagnostic lab background and had actually got my PhD in cancer biology. So, you know, had the tools, but then was recruited in and kind of taught food safety and meat processing and said, now there's the problem, help us fix it. And so we've been working on that ever since. Focused on 015787, which was the, and still is the biggest problem on the E. coli side of things.
That's great. Great to have you, your expertise, and to learn more about food safety. And just to touch base, this is a sponsored podcast by BioMario that's sponsoring today. So jump into some of the discussion points that we want to discuss of, you know, how did you become involved in some of this food safety research? You touched on, you know, getting recruited for ARS and not coming from necessarily this background, but can you touch on how you got really involved in food safety?
You know, this current position or this position, you know, being the research microbiologist working towards, you know, on food safety, controlling contamination, mostly in beef, a little pork, a little lamb, but, you know, focusing on controlling pathogens, learning from, you know, where animals are raised, all the way through how that influences something that can contaminate food that's heading towards a consumer. So, you know, that's sort of the problem put in front of me, as well as the high priority of 015787. You know, it was, you know, causing outbreaks and recalls and, you know, can be a very severe pathogen. And so that was, you know, large focus, you know, by the agency as well as you know, regulatory side of things as well, and the beef industry themselves. So, you know, we have a good working relationship with those different groups, and the, you know, that kind of, you know, is what put got behind all of it.
For over 60 years, bioMérieux has been a world leader in diagnostics, now revolutionizing the beef and meat industry with augmented diagnostics, addressing critical challenges such as food safety risks and recalls, production costs and waste, as well as environmental and consumer concerns. bioMérieux offers a fresh approach that goes beyond test results. Their unique portfolio of microbiology testing, genomics, data solutions, and expert insights help with pathogen detection, enumeration, and root cause analyses. By providing improved risk anticipation and comprehensive data, bioMérieux empowers beef processors to confidently navigate today's complexities.
So what exactly are STAC, or are STAC, as you told me that you've kind of switched how you call that, but what is STEC, and why would anyone be concerned with?
So the STEC, or, you know, STEC, so it's the Shiga toxin ST producing E. coli. So there's your E and C. So STEC, sometimes pronounced STEC, and I'll actually maybe use the word EHEC here when I talk about some of these, because there's a lot of STEC out there, but EHEC or enterohemorrhagic E. coli, and those are the ones that cause the most severe disease. So 015787, as I mentioned, you know, it is a STEC because it's a Shiga toxin producing E. coli, but it also carries some other virulence factors and things that make it more pathogenic, much more able to cause disease if you were to consume it. And so send those and a few other E. coli, then we refer to as the EHEX. And so the STEC produced that toxin. Toxin can can get into your bloodstream. It can cause diarrhea, bloody diarrhea, kidney failure, and, you know, if untreated, or, you know, in the elderly or young child, it can be an overwhelming infection and lead to death. And so, you know, it's an important pathogen. Fortunately, we don't see a lot of it, but, you know, when those infections occur, they get a lot of attention, and just because they can be such a problem.
Is it becoming a more of a increased awareness of it, or increased public health concern of some of these challenges?
Yeah. So, you know, things started with 0157 back in the 90s with, like, the first Jack in the Box outbreak and things. And, you know, focused was on that. And that's kind of when I started. But then somewhere in the 2000s there, CDC released a study where they saw, you know, that they were starting to see these other little non-0157 STEC. And so these E. coli make Shiga toxin. They carry some of the virulence factors. And when CDC was looking at all their attribution data, they said, oh, look, here's a 0157, and now here's this other group of six serotypes or serogroups of E. coli that are producing just as much disease as a 0157. It's not as severe. You know, there's only, you know, been a few deaths related to the non-0157s compared to 0157, but they can still cause similar disease. And so that awareness of, you know, looking for 0157 and then finding these additional STECs has kind of brought that, you know, more and more, you know, it's a more common test in clinical laboratories to screen, you know, feces samples from ill people for Shiga toxin. And then if they see the Shiga toxin, figure out why it's there. What's, you know, and so, you know, the diagnostics for it became more, so we're seeing more of it. And then globally, the WHO put out a report in the last few years where they are saying, you know, many more STECs or EHECs are the problem, and these are the things we should focus on. And it doesn't matter if they're 0157 or one of these other serogroups, anything that's making Shiga toxin and can bind inside of a person and cause an infection is a high priority. And so that shifting focus and definition, it kind of keeps broadening the net of STEC that we want to try and monitor and keep out of beef and other foods.
So what's driving these changes?
Part of it is testing and monitoring. Part of it is public awareness or pressures, you know, outbreaks, recalls, these things get people's attention, wanting to know what they are. And then just a lot of sequencing information, as you know, more and more of these isolates are found, they're more genomes are being sequenced, they're more being studied. And so we got this large growing repository of data that can be examined, and we can start looking at E. coli, the sugar toxin E. coli in our average EHEX, and start determining, you know, why are these more pathogenic? How do we focus on them? How can we control them? You know, and it's kind of a growing area, you know, of the, growing or getting a larger group of things to try and control, or, you know, they're being recognized easier, I guess, is one way of saying it.
As a research scientist at Clay Center, how do you share your research results? And I'm assuming these are going to like the more of the slaughter processing type of facilities research, or is it taking a step back and even on the feeding phase?
A little of both, actually. As I mentioned, you know, we work with the beef processors, as well as, you know, some feeders looking at ways to try and controlling these E. coli. I guess we should mention, you know, as part of background, they live naturally in cattle and they don't make cattle sick. So they live in cattle, they live in the feedlots. And from that point on, you know, they can carry them into processing plants. They get transferred to the carcass, then they can stay associated with the meat and end up in finished meat products. And so, you know, our product, you know, when we're working on these things, we've, you know, can have worked with some feedlot and feeders, and most of it is more on that processing side, because all the cattle do funnel through, you know, a harvest facility of some sort. And so that's kind of, you know, the pinch point where we can start applying ways to control these E. coli. Since those are sort of our stakeholder groups, you know, feeders, as well as, you know, the processors and regulators, you know, my science and our results, you know, first of all, you know, there's typical scientific publications, but also we, you know, we do work directly with processors, you know, the big three or four, as you would say. You know, we know all the, you know, people who are the sort of VPs of safety in those companies, have a good working relationship with them, you know, tell them what we're learning, or they'll come to us with a problem saying, how can we control this? You know, we've found a bunch of E. coli or had an incident, you know, or a situation. Let's learn from it. And so we'll work with them, you know, both ways, you know, providing, doing some studies. And they're really good about, you know, knowing that we're going to be, you know, impartial when we, you know, examine either some way of trying to decontaminate or control E. coli with an intervention, or compare some ways of detecting it. And, you know, so we give them those results of what we learned sometimes, you know, and often that's well before it ever gets into publication. You know, those, you know, they're getting these information from us straight from the lab many times on what we're finding and how they can start working to keep these things under control.
And assuming it really helps for your end of not only being at Clay Center, but being in a big beef state, that helps really disseminate and being able to get those results out.
Yeah, we've got three or four small processors available, and, you know, each of the big three are present, you know, within a few hours of the research center. And, you know, by having that good relationship, they will actually, you know, we are allowed to get into the processing plant and collect real samples, you know, from carcasses or during hide removal, or, you know, and, through. So it's a really good way of, you know, getting real relevant samples and not just, you know, things that, you know, we treated some E. coli on the bench in the laboratory, you know, we killed it, great. But if we take this into a real world situation, you know, what can we learn? And that's probably, you know, the main bread and butter, the main impact of what we're doing is we can, you know, get access to, you know, those real facilities and see, give measures on how these things work.
So what are the challenges that beef production has faced with this?
The biggest one, I mean, there's the pre-harvest side of things, you know, trying to understand how 0157 is living in cattle and if there's any way of reducing it in cattle. There's some, you know, vaccine approaches or sort of probiotic feed additives that have different effects on reducing it, but they still get carried into processing. And so the challenges there then are finding interventions, you know, organic acids get used a lot to clean carcasses and things to, you know, remove E. coli, injure it so that it can't grow or, you know, stay with the meat as it's further processed.
As was detecting a challenge?
Yeah. So if contamination does occur, you know, then the other side is properly detecting it. And, you know, basically every 2,000 pound combo, either individually or in batches of five, get tested, you know, all that beef trim before it's ever used for ground beef. You know, so we're talking thousands of tests performed to ensure, you know, safety systems at a processing plant are controlling E. coli, and then to make certain that any subsequent products don't have it. And so, as I mentioned, there's the 0157 and these non-0157s. And 0157 is kind of, you know, a very easy target. You know, it's the 0157H7. So it's a very specific serotype. So we know lots about it because we've been studying it many years. You know, hundreds of genomes of that organism have been sequenced. So by comparing all of them, some very good, you know, targets within the, you know, DNA targets that are very specific and sensitive, let us detect only 0157H7. And then on top of that, they're very easy or, yeah, they are very easy now to confirm that they're present, right? So I can, you know, have my beef, I screen it for 0157H7, I get a positive signal. 90-95% of the time, then I can find it because we know that it has a specific, you know, phenotype on certain augers. You know, they stand out on the plates and we look for them on petri dishes. We've got tools to help capture them and give us positive culture results. When you move into those other non-0157s, now you've got six serotype groups, and then each serogroup may have, you know, a few serotypes within it. So now, you know, we're talking going from one to a group of about 12 or more E. coli that we're trying to capture in a single test. And when you're trying to screen for those sorts of steck, it gets much more difficult because you've got so many things, so many differences. All you can start doing is looking for the targets that make them a stick, the sugar toxin gene. And I mentioned they, you know, to cause disease, they need to adhere in, inside your intestines. If you were to swallow one or eat one, eat some contaminated beef. So that other gene is typically intimate. So, you know, forms an intimate attachment, you know, to the inside of the GI tract, where it then causes disease. And so those two targets, sugar toxin and intamin, are the way that we approach testing or detecting the sticks. And that's the big challenge then is, you know, the industry will test everything for 0157 to ensure it's not present, and more importantly, show that, you know, their systems of interventions and processes are controlling E. coli. We know that the non-0157 stick react the same to peroxyacetic acid or lactic acid treated to a beef carcass and all the different you know, hot water wash, whatever is in place. We know that 0157 and non-0157 E. coli react similarly. So beef processors monitor to 0157H7 to ensure they're controlling all the E. coli that's coming through the system. You know, these other stecks, because we don't have a good way of determining if, you know, by those two genes, indicate a real pathogen is present. I guess, you know, the challenge is that, you know, I'm going to start talking about the genetics of E. coli a little bit, but there's the stec, they produce sugar toxin, and then there's the EHEC, they have the sugar toxin and that adherence gene, intamin. But then there's, you know, stec out there that only have sugar toxin, and they don't have a way to attach inside a host, so they don't really cause severe disease if they were to pass through you. And then that adherence gene can occur by itself in another group of E. coli. And so those E. coli don't really cause severe disease as well. But both those with the sugar toxin, those with Henneman, can be part of the sort of the background contamination if you're testing beef. So, you know, just a few E. coli in there can send what looks like a, give you a positive test for that sugar toxin and that Henneman. And that is why, you know, there's a resistance to, you know, even the regulators have trouble confirming their tests when they start testing for STEC versus a 1,5787. And so, you know, industry is focusing on controlling, monitoring a 1,5787. The regulators are testing for 1,5787 and the non-1,5787. You know, and that's the challenge, just come up with a good way of improving or finding the next steps on increasing the reliability of, you know, sugar toxin 9157 testing.
Since it's such a challenge to detect, what's your research been focused on of how do you detect these or you know, increasing the ability to detect these?
Yeah, so, you know, what some of the, I mentioned, you know, we have these large genome databases of genomes, and, you know, once you start kind of mining through all of that, you can find a few genes that will start segregating with, say, all sugar toxin in them and E. coli. You know, they're not absolute, you know, but, you know, we're following up on these various virulence factors that kind of associate with the 1,5,7 and the other severe disease-causing STECs. And, you know, there's some genes and sort of pathogenicity islands that will follow along more often with, you know, things that have sugar toxin in them and are less likely to be present in something that only has sugar toxin, you know, or only has Henneman. And so that's kind of where we've been working, is looking at various virulence factors. There was a study we did for the beef checkoff many years ago. We kind of dug through all the literature. We found like 20 virulence factors, and we just started screening carcasses at the processing plant, just, you know, off, you know, right after hide removal, so that these were contaminated carcasses or likely contaminated. And then we, you know, took those samples and tested them, and we found that the more virulence factors we found, the more likely we were able to confirm there was pathogenic E. coli. There, you know, there was no golden ticket there or, you know, key, but it was just kind of like, the more you find, we see 10 to 15, we can culture confirm this. If we see less than 12 and 8, we're not going to be able to culture confirm it. And so, you know, we knew there has to be, you know, some value in sorting out which the best virulence factors might work. And so that's kind of, you know, what our current work is looking at, is what virulence factors can help improve detection and, you know, and better ways of, say, enriching or processing a sample to collect, you know, to get to the point where the E. coli get to a good detectable level, and you can sort out whether or not they're pathogenic or just sort of a mixture of E. coli that are there.
Yeah, what have you found in strategies or processes for beef processors to ensure that their products are safe as possible?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, you know, safest products are keeping, you know, E. coli out of the process, out of finished products. And so, you know, there is 0157 monitoring. The other part is, you know, some of these virulence factors. A commercial test has come available recently. It's called PEC, or pathogenic E. coli. And, you know, we've analyzed and did some work on that test and actually have a, you know, paper out in the literature on it. And, you know, this has a test for a couple virulence factors that associate with those sugar toxin and positive E. coli. And, you know, if you use that test as your sort of your screen, it can tell you whether or not, you know, product is free to release. Because if you don't have the virulence factors present, the PEC test, then, you know, product is, you know, beef product, ground beef trim, that's, you know, free of, you know, sugar toxin and E. coli, and it's good to go. If it's present, then further testing, you know, some next steps you know, look for shigatoxin, look for the inamin, look for which O groups or serogroups groups of E. coli might be there. So, I mean, it, using the virulence factors as, you know, initial screen is, has potential, and it's actually part of FSIS's official method right now, where they use the, this PEC test along with the first deck screen to identify samples they want to further evaluate. And what we found was by using that approach, the markers are in all EHEC we tested, right? So everything that was shigatoxin endomin, no matter what serogroup or serotype of E. coli, you know, very common ones and very unusual or rare ones we don't often see, they were all positive with the test. We tested, you know, lots of things that were STEC, you know, shigatoxin, but lacked endomin, so therefore not very pathogenic. They all lack these targets. And then there's those others that carry the endomin alone, that other second adherence factor. And in that case, we could see maybe half of those E. coli carry these pathogenic factors. And that's partly because they're involved in some of that, or they've evolved along with that adherence factor as part of the disease-causing ability if shigatoxin is present. So we've got sort of a low level of background. And so when you use the PEC test, you're going to end up kind of cutting down, say, implicated or potential positive things in about half.
So what's the impact of your results, your studies have on STEC testing?
So, okay. So our result, impact of our results, some of the early on reports, you know, test and hold programs, testing for 15787 and not releasing any product until it's confirmed negative. You know, we did some of those very early tests 20 years ago, and that really influenced the process and how those were put in place. More recently, you know, we've got, like I mentioned, we've studied the PEC test. We're looking at other tests and methods of approaching testing that can tell us whether or not, you know, shigatoxin and endomin are in the same E. coli to have a more confidence on what we're testing, you know, whether or not the positive result you get is a true positive. And then on the backside of that, we're also trying to come up with better improved ways to isolate or identify that STEC if it's present, you know, get it back out or find it. And in that case, you know, we're finding there's a bunch more of these potentially EHEC out there that may end up being, you know, part of the regulatory definition someday. But that's kind of, you know, where the impact is going. A lot of the mentioned FSIS is using the PEC, and a lot of the, you know, their initial decision to investigate that test and evaluate it was work that we had done with and for them, part of an interagency agreement and data sharing. They provided samples, we provided analysis and further workup on the samples. So it helped, you know, you got that test, you know, into their hands, they're using it. And then, you know, we've been presenting it to, at say a beef checkoff or the, at a beef safety summit meeting to, you know, kind of explain to the industry, this is what the test is, because since FSIS is starting to use it, there's a lot of question on, you know, what is the test? How can it be used? Should we be using it? If we start using it, what will we see? And so that's sort of, you know, where we stand is kind of trying to advise, you know, the industry if they need to do the testing. What will you see? And, you know, what can you expect? Because if they start using it, then they want to have, you know, more positives than just a 15787 alone. And they're going to want to be able to determine, you know, what did they have to do with that product that might be implicated.
So, you know, being fast and accurate is very important. So what is needed to increase the speed and accuracy of these tests?
So, yeah, increase the speed and accuracy. I mean, the tests are, you know, use PCR pretty much just to look for the gene. I mean, you can't really change the speed there. You know, the machine runs and amplifies the DNA as fast as it can. It's usually on the preparation side, you know, collecting the beef sample, processing that beef sample, getting it into some media, getting that E. coli to grow to a detectable level. Those are the things that they're actually working on in the lab now, is coming up with ways, you know, can we culture that piece of beef for 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, and get it into a detection test as fast as possible? You know, and then, so that's where we're working on that. And then, you know, accuracy comes into how reliable is the test? Is it giving us, you know, can we culture confirm that sample is positive, you know, when we look at the screen? You know, I guess, you know, we did a study where we compared, you know, 5 or 6 different STEC detection methods, you know, across 500 samples that came from a service lab. And we found, you know, each test method we used found, you know, 20% of those samples positive, but they only all agreed like on 2 samples. So, and one was the only true culture confirmable sample there. So, you know, that was good. You know, they all found the positive, but they disagreed on so many other samples that, you know, that's where the challenge is in all of this. And so you want, you know, finding accuracy and coming up with some way of being able to say this is positive, diverting that, you know, meat to a cooked stream of some sort so that, you know, it stays out of, you know, out of the raw, you know, out of consumers' hands and, you know, is made safe.
So what are the areas of opportunities when it comes to that detection, testing, et cetera, for, you know, the near future and for further out?
I think there's we looked at pathogenic E. coli tests. There's a few other markers or virulence factors. I think a number of companies are trying to follow that model now that it's been put out by BioMaru, who made the PEC test. And so I think we're going to see more virulence factor focused testing, giving us more reliable detection of those STEC, you know, in the short term. You know, we've had, you know, conference calls and things with companies looking for, you know, what targets or what things can we use to improve testing for STEC. And then further out in the future, I could almost see us, instead of targeting these genes, we may just, yeah, take a sample of beef, enrich it for some amount of time, and just sequence everything that's present. You know, if we can get sequencing condensed down to a very, you know, even more economical approach than it is now, we can, you know, find and assemble pathogens if they're present, you know, their genomes. And so I think, you know, that's sort of, you know, the distant future. But, you know, currently I think we're going to see more and more of these virulence-focused tests that can give us better accuracy for identifying these E. coli.
Well, to wrap us up, is there anything you want to touch on that we didn't discuss?
I guess maybe on the, we've been talking so much about detection, but, and I've mentioned culture confirmation side, and that's the other sort of growing area of improvement is, you know, 0157-87, I mentioned, easy to culture. You know, it doesn't ferment sorbitol. So if you put it on a plate of agar with sorbitol, the colonies don't eat that sugar. They're easy to see. The other stacks, there's a few media out there that help identify them if they're present. FSIS uses an agar called Rainbow, and you see purple and pink colonies of E. coli, and you pick those and test to see if they're the one that you're after. There's a chrome agar. This is another media. Your stacks can be pink on it, and it helps, you know, is, you know, very selective, because when you try to culture these things, you get lots of stuff growing there, and you want just a single colony that's your E. coli. And then there's a new product we've found that's been shared with us. And in this case, we're looking for Shigatoxin E. coli. And if those E. coli are growing on the plate expressing Shigatoxin, there's actually a zone around the colonies that make Shigatoxin. And so we're looking at this going, wow, you know, where was this all our lives? Because really lets us, you know, focus in on finding things that are STEC and improving our rate of isolating these things and have a more of a reliable confirmation side.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, to wrap us up here, I've got three questions. And the first one is what is your go-to highly recommended beef or food safety resource that you would recommend someone utilizing?
So I guess on the food safety side, there's Food Protection Trends is a great journal that covers lots of variety of things. And then there's also a couple good textbooks out there that I and a number of our folks at Clay Center have contributed chapters to on everything from pre-harvest to post-harvest and each of the pathogens, E. coli and salmonella control. So those are kind of where I usually, if I need to find facts.
What's a non-ag book that you highly recommend someone reading?
There's actually a pair of books that I really enjoy and kind of go back to them. They're called 1491 and 1493. And they're basically, you know, taking that year that, you know, we say, you know, Columbus discovered America in 1492. And it looks at and describes, you know, the civilizations and the cultures before that point and then after that point. And they talk about, you know, how many peoples and civilizations were here. A lot of, you know, it does look like have some agriculture in there because it talks about, you know, the crops and the things they were growing. And then after 1492 starts talking about the trades and how, you know, certain things like sugar and rubber kind of shaped our modern society that we don't really see, you know, so that's a really, those are probably two of my more favorite books to kind of go back and look at.
So what, in your opinion, what sets apart a successful beef or food safety professional?
So I think part of it's probably communication, which, you know, I don't know if I excel at very well, but, you know, when you're, if you're looking, say, you know, in the beef industry, you know, the most successful folks there are the ones who can, you know, talk safety to management all the way down to, you know, the guys working on the line where, you know, this is important. We found this, you know, making certain that, you know, the folks who are calling the shots and doing the budgeting and things and making decisions for how things are going to run, you know, how they understand it, but then also being able to communicate its importance and explain to the guys on the line on how and what needs to be done. So I think having that skill set and be able to communicate across the board is probably one of the more important things there.
Yeah, it's important for almost all aspects of what we do. And so especially the ability to translate science, high-level science, down to common, easy to pick up and utilize, and, you know, whether it's beef processing plants, etc.
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge to just kind of share it in this format without having, you know, my slide deck and a pointer.
Yeah, great. Well, Mick, thank you for the time and your expertise and some of these issues with stack and pathogens and some of the challenges we're faced in the beef industry.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.